This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This Slate Political Gabfest Extra is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring but not sure where to find the best candidates? As a business owner, your company is only as good as the people you hire, and posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. But when you're short-staffed, there's no time to deal with the dozens of different job sites. Until now. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites with one single click. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. Be instantly matched to candidates from more than 4 million resumes. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 400,000 businesses, and you can try it right now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Try ZipRecruiter and get your perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/GabFest. That's ZipRecruiter.com/GabFest. Again, ZipRecruiter.com/GabFest.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to a GabFest Extra for September 25th, 2015. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I am here in the Slate DC studio with Jamel Bowie, Slate's chief political correspondent. Hello, Jamel.
Hello, David.
John Dickerson is trapped in the Face the Nation studio where he is preparing probably for his John Boehner interview, his big John Boehner interview, which will be coming up. And joining us by phone from somewhere is Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hey.
So it's Friday morning, and we taped the GabFest yesterday. And then what does John Boehner do? He goes and announces, or he tells Republican officials that he is going to step down in October as Speaker of the House. So, Jamel, he apparently made this decision after seeing the Pope, the papal visit sealed the deal for him. But what's the sort of basic reason that Boehner's giving it up?
Well, I don't think we have any exact reason why he's giving it up, but I think the thing everyone is pointing to, it's just the fact that he is struggling to prevent a shutdown over defunding Planned Parenthood. This is the sort of second or third consecutive time this sort of thing has happened. House conservatives despise him, think he's sort of spineless and gutless and not defending their interest. And I think he's just tired of it. He just doesn't want to do it anymore, which is an entirely fair conclusion to come to.
His stepping down in the short term, his stepping down, the theory seems to be that there will now be a clean funding bill passed, at least for the short term. I don't really understand why his stepping down causes a clean funding bill to get passed, because Democrats will vote for it.
Right.
With some Republicans.
Well, I think the theory is that because he's no longer worried about protecting his position as Speaker of the House, then he kind of, it doesn't really matter what conservatives do. He can get a clean funding bill through with Democrats and moderate Republicans, and he can just leave.
Emily, there's some great metaphors for Boehner, great descriptions of him. I mean, obviously, people talk about his teariness, his orangeness, but I loved the one that went around today of him as the giving tree. Which is that
who's letting himself be
he's allowed himself to be cut into pieces, and all that remains of him is this stump. Why does that metaphor resonate? What is it that has happened to him, at least according to his supporters, that makes him like that?
I think if you're not one of his arch-conservative critics, you feel like this guy basically was one of them, but he chose to play an establishment role in which threatening to shut down the government is irresponsible and counterproductive, and he wanted to be a grown-up, and he has gotten slammed for that every step of the way by the more rebellious members of his party, and it seems kind of crazy that he has to take the fall so that they can decide to keep the government open. I don't exactly get it. And then the other thing is there's something poignant about this timing. I mean, we were discussing the Pope's visit on Thursday, and thinking, huh, will this really have any effect on policy? And I think we started talking about Boehner, and John Dickerson said, you know, yeah, maybe I'll ask him about this when I interview him this weekend, because it seemed like if anyone was emotionally affected, it was Boehner, who was weeping. And I just wonder if there was something about that cathartic emotional moment that made him think there's just something wrong here and I don't want to stand for it anymore.
Early reports say yes. Early reports say that the visit clarified and maybe had him make this decision faster than he might have.
I mean, who can blame him? What is it like to be the person who gets carved into pieces by the people who you essentially agree with, or you agree with about substance, if not about tactics? It must just be incredibly galling and frustrating.
Jamel, the last few speakers, except for Pelosi, who just kind of lost, but many of the last House speakers have ended their tenure in disgrace. Newt Gingrich did, Mark Foley did, Jim Wright did. Bob Livingston, who briefly flirted with being speaker, did. Denny Hastert didn't end in disgrace, although he's since been disgraced. What is it about this job that is so unappealing?
I think that for Republicans in particular, I mean, broadly, the job is just kind of thankless. It's a very powerful and important position in government, but it's not very high visibility. It's mostly sort of coalition wrangling and trying to keep your caucus together to actually pursue something constructive. I think for Republicans in particular, there is this wide and growing divide between what I just call sort of lawmakers, people who are there to actually do things,
right,
and then people who are there really to make some sort of ideological statement. And those people have no real regard for, you know, congressional traditions or norms or even sort of just the function and structure of things. And so if you are the leader of those people, it just becomes almost an impossible game. It's hard to sort of balance those two things because they always stand as a potential threat to your power. And Democrats don't seem to have that problem as speaker. Just they don't seem to have that kind of ideological sort of minority pressing against them.
But the weird thing about that is that's only a problem if you assume that the way to be speaker is that you only pass bills using your party. If Boehner said, you know what, I'm going to do a speakership where I'm going to be in the middle and I'm going to pass bills where I'm going to get 140 Republicans and 100 Democrats and we're going to get bills that way, that would be a perfectly legit – that would be a great way to go. But he refused
to do
that.
But how could you ever get elected speaker and keep the job if you were doing
what happened is that he has enough of his caucus who are saying we're going to have a force of no confidence vote about you so you cannot remain speaker. I mean, I didn't really understand how a no confidence vote – no confidence vote wouldn't literally strip him of the speakership, would it? If he didn't get a majority of votes in a no confidence?
No, it wouldn't strip him of the speakership. It would just be a sign. Let's say, you know, of the – I don't even know the numbers off the top of my head. But if a quarter of the Republican caucus voted against him, that's like a sure sign that he's probably not going to win re-election as speaker. So it kind of makes him a lame duck.
But what I don't understand is if he could make a case to Democrats, this is what no one will do. But if he could make a case to Democrats that I'll be a speaker who is in between. I mean, this is a fantasy world. But it's a fantasy world where you say I'll be in between.
I don't understand what you're talking about. It's not our system. We don't have that system. We have two parties.
No,
the speaker is the Republican speaker.
Well, no.
The speaker is elected by the whole Congress.
No, that's how it works. But it doesn't. Fine.
But
come on.
Once you accept that as a premise, then you say it is the majority of the majority that makes all the decisions.
Right. I mean, so I think
right. That's been the case for years. That was the Hastert rule. This goes back.
Yeah, it's a terrible rule.
It has to do with ideological division and partisan reality. It's reflecting the reality of the political map, not some like strange choice John Boehner made to do this job this way.
Institutionally, David makes a correct observation, but practically, Emily is right that House is governed by what's called political scientists called party cartels. Basically, it's majority of the majority, not necessarily majority of the full body. And that's in part because, or largely because, the distance between, say, the most conservative Democrat and the most liberal Republican is still astoundingly huge. Maybe there are procedural questions and procedural issues on which you could sort of craft majorities from Democrats and Republicans. But as soon as anything has any ideological substance, there's no way to maintain that coalition.
Although, weirdly, Jamel, in this case, it's being governed by the minority of the majority. Boehner certainly has the support of the majority of House Republicans. It's just that there is a significant enough minority of House Republicans who express dismay or discontent with him. I don't see how...
And that is arguably the Republicans' weakness, right? I mean, this is where the fact that the Democrats don't have as strong a kind of super liberal, or whatever you want to call it, faction is a strength for them because it's easier for them to unite around one leader, or at least it was when Pelosi was in the House.
Or I'll say it's not that Democrats don't have a strong sort of liberal minority. They do. It's that even that strong liberal minority is constrained by interest group politics in a way that the Republican conservative minority just isn't. That, like, ultimately someone like Keith Ellison has concrete things he wants to get
right.
done.
Right.
Steve Scalise does not.
Exactly.
Does not.
He's come there to destroy the institution. He's come there to undermine the idea of lawmaking and legislating. Exactly. Right. If you have 10% or 20% of Congress that doesn't want to do the job, doesn't fundamentally believe in its interest, then that's problematic.
Actually was elected not to go along with the people who want to go to the job, do the job. Right. I mean, that's why that was the appeal to the voters.
Given all that, Jamel, how can there be a speaker who could do a better job than Boehner? It's the early tip sheet says Kevin McCarthy, who's the House Majority Leader. Literally never. I had never seen that guy until yesterday. I did not know. Behind the Pope, and I was like, who is that guy behind the Pope? And then I
bet Jamel knew who he was.
I knew who he was.
He just didn't.
Okay, but anyway, so Kevin McCarthy, this kind of seemingly not terribly interesting or bright California Republican, is the person being tipped to be the next speaker. Is there any reason to think that Kevin McCarthy has some sort of magic that allows him to do what Boehner couldn't?
Not at all. I mean, he's more conservative than Boehner. He's the conservative members of the House like him more. That's part of why he was tapped to be House Majority Leader after Eric Cantor lost. Was that last year? I think if McCarthy decides to try to go down the path Boehner did and act as an institutional actor and rather than a Republican one, he'll end up at least with the same frustrations.
He'll get Boehner, right.
I think the most likely outcome is that McCarthy, who more so than Boehner, who's been in Congress less long than Boehner, and so more so than Boehner, it doesn't seem as tied to the House as an institution, might just go along with the conservatives and might end up leading them on these pointless fights. And that will keep him a speaker longer, but it will be very unhelpful for the process of governing.
Well, game that out. So imagine that instead of Boehner, there's a speaker who in fact is willing to go to the mats, is willing to sort of push for defunded Planned Parenthood, is willing to shut down the government. Doesn't it ultimately always end the same way, which is that, you know, Boehner always had to fold? Aren't these guys always going to have to fold, at least as long as there's a Democratic president, because they don't have enough to override any vetoes and they can't leave the government shut down forever? Isn't that going to be the case or not necessarily?
I mean, certainly if you're going to be extremely irresponsible, it doesn't have to be the case. But assuming Kevin McCarthy doesn't want to go down in history as the single worst speaker, you know, since the 1850s, I think he ends up in the same place. He has to fold. And the thing about Boehner's strategy is that by announcing essentially that you have to fold earlier, I think it actually made the backlash less bad than it was. But if you're going to lead conservatives on to think that they're going to win, then at the last moment fold, I can't expect McCarthy will stay much popular with conservatives much longer.
Is there any safe path for McCarthy or whoever gets this job where you – can you ever get away with, I did the best I could, I tried really hard to lead the charge and sustain it, I just have to fold at the last minute? Or is that just always going to be seen as craven and disastrous?
I think that if McCarthy were backed up by other institutional Republicans in the Senate and sort of outside Congress and other Republican Party actors, that could work. You know, you could have the Heritage Foundation, you could have Ted Cruz and everyone saying, well, this is the best possible
can
outcome.
Can you imagine Ted Cruz ever saying that? That's not going to happen.
This is the problem, right? That that McCarthy will be saying one thing, just as Boehner has been saying one thing, and you'll have Jim DeMint and Ted Cruz and sort of the entire right-wing infrastructure saying, well, you just sold us out.
The only one person who's able to do this in any fashion in recent years was Newt Gingrich, who for a few years was able to, with a Democratic president able to drive the agenda. He didn't get everything he wanted by any means, but there was the perception for several years in the 90s while Jamel was in preschool that that in fact Republicans were totally driving the agenda and making the decisions. And Clinton, it was always Clinton sort of triangulating, playing defense. And so even though Gingrich, I don't think Gingrich won a higher percentage of those fights than Boehner did, Gingrich definitely was seen as the prime mover. But there's nobody in the House now who's seen as a prime mover. There's nobody who is the who's a kind of leading figure who represents a specific set of, you know, there was the Contract for America that Gingrich had, but there's no specific set of, like, here are the five specific things that we are going to demand and push for, which you could have. You could imagine a House leadership which said, these are the five bills that matter most to us. We're going to push them. We're going to force the president to veto this stuff, force the Senate
to filibuster.
But
isn't the difference between that 90s Congress and this Congress the nihilistic nature of what these right-wing Republicans seem to want? They want to repeal Obamacare. They want to defund Planned Parenthood. They're not putting forth...
Right. I guess they do have an agenda, right? They do have an agenda. It's just like it makes no sense.
Yeah.
Right. You're right. That's a good point. Emily, just one closing question, or Jamel, you can take this too. Do we think that Boehner's departure will have measurable impact on the presidential race?
I think it will, in the sense that the person who got to announce that to a room full of conservative activists was Marco Rubio, who is currently under the radar but trying to make himself the least objectionable figure to every major faction in the Republican Party. And it's noteworthy that Rubio got huge cheers for announcing this at the Values Voters Conference this morning. And I think that this is the kind of thing that will boost his – just the fact that this is something he can announce it, he can say this is a good thing, or he's in an oblique way say that this is a good thing, helps him build a stature with, I think, the part of the Republican establishment with which he has the least influence.
But take a longer view on this, Emily. Going back to your point of a minute ago, Jamel, is that whoever the next speaker is, if the next speaker has to be more confrontational and has to push for these sorts of showdowns, who is that likely to benefit in the presidential campaign? Is it likely to benefit the party in general in the presidential campaign, or is it going to be damaging if the House adopts a more confrontational posture?
I mean, this is the essential tension for the Republicans. In the short term, or maybe even the medium term, and among hardcore Republican voters, this benefits someone like Rubio and gives him one more reason to be the nominee instead of someone like Jeb Bush, right? Someone more palatable to the harder right. But then can that person get elected? And does the country ever get to a point where the willingness, the eagerness of really hardcore right-wing Republicans to sacrifice the people in their party who act more responsible just becomes too much? And the reason it's so hard for the country to get that place with the House has to do with redistricting, right? I mean, this part of the House comes from incredibly safe Republican districts, and so it's very hard to see that dynamic changing. But I feel like the sacrifice of Boehner is like the beating that John Roberts took at the last Republican debate, where suddenly, you know, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, who has, in fact, you know, provided the fifth vote to save Obamacare twice, which was a very good thing for the Republican Party, right? Quietly, everyone breathes a sigh of relief over that. Also true about the gay marriage decision, not that Roberts actually voted for that, but he has led the court down a path that is very good for mainstream Republicans, and yet he is the person who Ted Cruz is the most eager to pillage.
That's a great point. John Boehner, we'll miss him. He's one of the few House people I ever interviewed back when I was covering politics. I really liked interviewing him. He was very...
Why?
You know, it was very fun. He was very straight and sort of... I mean, I'm sure he was bullshitting me in some fashion, but it felt like a very direct kind of conversation. And he's very much like an old-time Paul. He's somebody,
right,
who was caring about sort of how the game is played and like thinking about the game. He's not ideological. He isn't. he was a politician.
Not a Jacobin.
He's not a Jacobin. He's a what's the opposite of a Jacobin?
The Girondist.
How do you spell that?
Jamel, where are you pulling this from? I am sorry. Like, how is that in your brain? I'm sorry, my voice is rising in shock. But seriously, I've never even heard that word before.
How do you spell it?
It's Girond.
Oh, yeah.
They're like the French Girond establishment left.
Yeah. David, don't even try to pretend that you had that in your head at the top of it.
They were sort of like, we probably shouldn't execute so many people.
Right. The Jacobins are the sans-culottes, too, right? They're the same?
Well, the sans-culottes are the
I am not playing this game.
The Paris sort of like street mob that...
They're the Tea Party.
Yeah, that various factions tried to sort of co-opt for their ends.
Okay.
And now, Jamel, are you going to sing from Les Miserables to close us out?
I've just been reading about the French Revolution recently.
Uh-huh. Jean Bonnet, the resignation of House Speaker Jean Bonnet. Thanks for listening to this GabFest Extra. We'll be back with a regular show next week. Thank you, Jamel Bowie and Emily Bazelon. And our producer today is Mike Fuolo.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.